minutes a day, 365 days a year. This is the Pack-A-Day Podcast.
Hello once again, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Pack-A-Day Podcast, your 24/7 stop for all things green and gold. My name is Mike Wellen, and joining me, as always, is Chris Schimmel today. And Chris, it's the offseason. It's a little more relaxed. Combine hasn't started yet. We're just kind of starting into draft stuff. So it's a chance to take a step back and look at other more fun, non-quite-topical football topics, I guess. How is the offseason treating you so far?
Pretty good. I mean, this offseason is definitely more relaxable than last season because there was a lot of what-ifs going into last season. But here, you know, you feel like you have a lot more confidence going into this next offseason. But then again, there's a lot even more higher expectations heading into this offseason too. So you're excited, but it's definitely more relaxing than last offseason.
Absolutely. And so with this offseason kind of going right now, it's a little more laid back, even though expectations will be raised. It's a good chance to take a look at kind of the situation that Matt LaFleur has found himself in. He set all kinds of records, team and otherwise, in his first year, getting 13 wins, becoming the first Packer rookie coach to get into the playoffs, and just kind of stepping things up back from where the Packers used to be in. And it got us both thinking about other coaches who have jumped in with a Hall of Fame quarterback on their first year on the job, whether it's an older one or a younger one. We'll focus a little bit on both, but how do they do from their first to second year? So, and how can we use that to try and tie in things to what Matt LaFleur might be able to do in year two in 2020? And we have eight coaches up for you guys. We'll go through them. We'll go through Mike McCarthy, Tony Dungy, Jim Caldwell, Mike Shanahan, Jimmy Johnson, Mike Tomlin, George Seifert as well, and Sean Payton. And I guess kind of diving right in, again, don't forget as well to follow Pack-A-Day Podcast at Pack-A-Day Podcast and wherever great podcasts are found. I think, Chris, it's fitting that we start with Mike McCarthy because there's a lot of parallels between Matt LaFleur's situation and what McCarthy came into when he came in 2006.
Yeah, definitely. You know, when a lot of I feel like a lot of Packer fans were scratching their heads when Mike McCarthy was first hired, not hearing too much about him beforehand. But it's kind of crazy to think because I was in sixth grade when McCarthy was hired. So I don't, you know, so for most of my life, it's been under McCarthy. So it's kind of hard to think of what it really was under Mike Sherman. But of course, Favre, I think, had a lot more freedom under Mike Sherman. And then McCarthy came in and, you know, changed the team into, you know, how a coach comes in and they want the team to be modeled after them. So, of course, that's going to be different or challenging for Favre. But, yeah, I see the same kind of thing. And especially given that McCarthy inherited a team that went 4-12. The previous year, they started 0-4, were 2-10, and then were 4-12. So I think McCarthy had an enormous amount of responsibility and an enormous amount of pressure on him. And I saw the same thing with LaFleur this season.
Absolutely, yeah. I was a freshman in high school when this happened, so I was right in my youth, right when the Sherman era and the Ray Rhodes era were going. But I remember, yeah, when McCarthy came in and he brought in Jeff Jagodzinski as the offensive coordinator. Bob Harlan was still around, still doing the hiring. Ted Thompson was still around there. They projected to go 6-10 his first year, and they looked to be on that pace with McCarthy, but he did win 4-8 and 8-8 to start there. But then going into year two, with Joe Philbin promoted to offensive coordinator, they made that next big jump. They went 13-3 in what I think was Favre's last season as the starter. Favre at 28 touchdowns, 15 picks. They got to the divisional round where they fell to the Giants in overtime as
championship game.
conference championship game against the Giants. I'm trying to forget the weekend that happened because Corey Webster is still my personal enemy to this day. But so it's kind of the opposite where he started off all right and then he got big. LaFleur started out huge early on. Can he keep that 13-3 pace? But again, with an aging quarterback who got reined in by the coach. Rodgers had 29 picks, I think, in his last year under Sherman. He drops that down to 15 and 18 and then 15 during that time under McCarthy. So is there a similarity there that whether LaFleur can get the same kind of cooperation under Rodgers that we saw this year, as that we saw Favre with McCarthy as the couple years went on?
Yeah, they're both the same and both different. Like, where they both need, the coaches need to rein in the quarterback, but under completely different circumstances. Favre, it was, you know, he was a gunslinger, shoot from the hip, throwing a lot of boneheaded interceptions. With Rodgers, it's, you know, you're not, you don't have to be Superman anymore. You don't have to put up these amazing numbers. You have to let the bullet, you know, you have to let the football fly instead of throwing it away. You need to learn how to hit your checkdowns, get into this new system. So both quarterbacks, I saw Favre as uncomfortable too when he first started going into McCarthy's system. And I thought the same thing with Rodgers. You saw how the offense was stagnant throughout most of the beginning of the season. And then finally things started to gel a little bit. And then same thing, of course, you know, people always bring up, you know, what Matt Ryan was when his first year under a system. And then in year two, he wins MVP. So I see it's hard to think of the Packers getting even better than 13-3. But they might not be 13-3. They might go 11-5 or 12-4. But I feel like they'll be even more of a complete team.
That I agree with 100%. I think it's going to be similar to what we saw with the McCarthy years. But even more, just more entertaining, I'm looking at some of the stuff from that second year. Charles Woodson was a primary punt returner. You had great luminaries like Corin Robinson on the team, Carlisle Holiday. There's some fascinating names to go back and look at. Marquand Manuel at safety. It's fascinating to see these teams 15 years ago now when you think about it with Mike McCarthy. But there are so many similarities that it's amazing. I mean, then you look at the run McCarthy went on, because he dropped to 6-10 the next year with Rodgers, but then 11 wins, 10 wins, 15 wins, 11 wins. He ended up winning 10 games 8 times with the Packers, and which, if we can get that out of Matt LaFleur again, I think that's a massive, massive success. And I hope that the similar model can be followed by Matt LaFleur that we saw under McCarthy, like he's talked about getting the quarterbacks buying in consistently, getting them to play their game and letting him dictate the way the team goes like a good head coach can do.
Yeah, definitely. Completely agree. And I'm just looking at Favre's, you know, statistics. His last year with Sherman and his 2 years under McCarthy, you know, his passer rating went from 70.9 to 72.7 to 95.7. I mean, that's a huge, what is that? It's 23 points in 1 year. That's pretty amazing. I'm not saying Rodgers is going to go from, you know, 95.4 and then up 23 points, but if he can just keep continuously buying into the system, they get him some more weapons this offseason. I feel like this team, you know, because of the expectations, they have nowhere to go but up.
No, I agree. So let's move on. Let's take a look at another coach who there are some really eye connections with. Green Bay going back to his time with Denver and also his son just beating Green Bay, and that's Mike Shanahan. He ended up with kind of later his career with John Elway, and of course he won a couple Super Bowls at the end as well. So I guess talk about year one and year two. I know you did a lot more research than I did on Shanahan. Talk about what you saw from him in years one and year two.
Yeah. Well, Mike Shanahan, you know, people always talk about him in Denver. You know, he only was the head coach in Denver from 1995 to 1998. He retired after that, you know, second Super Bowl win with the team. And then, of course, he came back. It's like coaches just can't stay away from the game. It's just in their blood. But, you know, you look at the year before, they were 7-9. They were 10th in the league in points, 21.7 points a game. John Elway had, you know, it's kind of hard to look back at statistics and compare them to today. For example, 1995, John Elway threw 16 touchdowns. You'd think if a player threw 16 touchdowns in today's game, you'd say this guy is garbage, you know. But going back, Elway had a statistically good season. But then 1995, under Shanahan's first year, there wasn't huge improvement. They went from 7-9 to 8-8. So to think the Packers going, you know, to 13-3, I don't think people really understand how huge of a good rookie year Matt LaFleur had. Like, I think he has by far the best rookie year in Packer history. But you take a look, their points per game increased from 21.7 to 24.3. But John Elway, he was still throwing the ball because he was so used to being Superman. He threw the ball 542 times. And he put up good numbers. Defense was okay, right in the middle of the pack. But then it was in 1996, 1 year into his second year, where he finally tried to embraced Shanahan's philosophy. And you just take a look at the numbers. His passing attempts went from 542 to 466. That's when Terrell Davis really started becoming the leader of the team. And his numbers passing yards went down 600 yards, but they were winning, and they're actually scoring more points than ever before. You know, his touchdown percentage went from 4.8% to 5.6%. His completion percentage went from 58.3 to 61.6. And then, so it took a while for Elway to adapt, and the same thing's going to be for Rodgers.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of parallels there with these two, especially you talk about Elway having to be Superman, and he had to be the Denver Broncos for a long time until Terrell Davis came in his prime, and you saw some stuff with Shanahan coming in, and Shanahan stayed till 2008, then he went to Washington for a few years, but with Shanahan, Elway, much like we're seeing, I think, now with LaFleur, Rodgers, and Aaron Jones, the quarterback doesn't need to be the guy. You can lean on your running game. You can have some good receivers, lean on his strong defense, and you can still win a Super Bowl. Elway was at the very, very end, though, which I think is the big difference, whereas Rodgers still has a few years left, I think, but Elway was almost done, but he was able to show up late, and I think the leadership and hard-headedness of Shanahan went a long way to help that out.
Yeah, and Shanahan was interviewed, and he said the main difference is that Rodgers has already won a Super Bowl while Elway hadn't won any. So they were just trying to win one. And so that's the same kind of mindset with Rodgers, is win one more. You take a look at, you know, we just talked about McCarthy and with Favre. They went from 4-12 to 8-8 to 13-3. Shanahan, they went from 7-9 to 8-8 to 13-3. The Packers went straight to 13-3. And so that's why it's a little bit different. It's almost like the Packers almost skipped the first year and just went straight to the second. And so hopefully that's why I'm so excited for this next year to see what they can do. Because Rodgers, they won even without him putting up those numbers, even though Rodgers kind of think he had to. But I don't know. I feel like it's kind of refreshing to see Rodgers not have to be Superman. And I know he still feels like he has to, but you just think of the Cowboys game with Aaron Jones running for four touchdowns.
No, I agree. And so let's move on to another coach kind of in that similar boat, and that's Tony Dungy. Dungy was inexplicably fired by Tampa after 2001. Granted, they did go and win the Super Bowl the next year with John Gruden with Dungy's players, but Dungy goes to the Colts. And he's got a still young Peyton Manning. But it's still quarterback who realizes he can easily be Superman, has control of the offense, all checks at the line. They go 10-6 in Dungy's first year at the Colts. The next year, they jump up to 12-4. Then they win 12-14, 12-13, and 12. So that 10-6 year was the worst year Dungy had with the Colts.
That's pretty amazing.
But even in that 2002 season with Dungy, Peyton Manning, 27 touchdowns, 19 interceptions. He was 26. He had guys like Edgerrin James. He had Marvin Harrison. So there were plenty of weapons around at that point. Reggie Wayne was still pretty was young as well. The next season with Peyton Manning as quarterback at age 27, 29 touchdowns, 10 interceptions. And again, they went pretty solidly into the conference championship where they fell to the Patriots. That first year under Tony Dungy, they lost in the wild card game and they got shellacked by the New York Jets 41 to nothing. But a younger quarterback, but another quarterback who had complete control of the line of scrimmage, complete control of the checkout of any play he wanted with Peyton Manning. Some really talented young receivers with Harrison and Wayne, a very good running back in Edgerrin James. And I think that's what similarity is you have that quarterback who has complete control of the offense like Peyton Manning did and with Aaron Rodgers. Except Dungy, again, that very highly motivator, that guy, even more like LaFleur, who the players really respect in the locker room, who they realize they can count on in the locker room. And I think that's where the similarities are between Dungy and LaFleur.
Yeah, you know, Dungy, of course, is a defensive-minded coach. So it is a little bit different, but at the same time, you're dealing with a quarterback who has complete control of the line of scrimmage. A lot of coaches aren't used to having that. Like, people are always talking about LaFleur whether or not he's going to give Rodgers the freedom to audible, change the play at the line of scrimmage, because he wasn't used to having a quarterback do that. And then another similarity you just said Tony Dungy is I have a Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson, of course, everyone remembers him as the coach of the Cowboys. People need to remember he also was the coach of the Dolphins from 1996 to 1999, and he had Dan Marino. And everyone thought that with Shula retiring, Jimmy Johnson would be able to finally take Dan Marino to a Super Bowl championship. And instead, nothing. They really remained stagnant. They were 9-7 before he got there. He gets there, and they go 8-8. And then the next year, they go 9-7. And Marino, once again, not having the same weapons as he once had, remains stagnant. So I feel, well, Tony Dungy was successful, McCarthy was successful, and Shanahan was successful. There are some exceptions, and that big one is Jimmy Johnson with Dan Marino. Did you take a look at that one?
I didn't take it too much of a look at that, no. But I'm trying to remember, if that might have been Marino's last couple of years where he lost his last game 62-7 in the playoffs.
Yeah, I guess the Jaguars. Yeah, that's brutal.
But that's the one where it's opposite personality-wise, because Jimmy Johnson was that loud, boisterous, yep, how about them Cowboys coach, and then he also ended up going, how about them Dolphins? Whereas someone like where Johnson had that ego and he had that confidence and that boisterous personality, whereas guys like Shanahan, LaFleur, Dungy are kind of that more reserved taskmaster, take care of your own business type coach.
Yeah.
Which I think resonates more with a quarterback. I think would have resonated more with a quarterback like Marino, who was very cerebral, very much a guy who wanted to take care of his own stuff. And Marino had been to a Super Bowl 15 years earlier, but he never got back. And I think it remains whether Johnson was the right guy to try and get him back at the end of his career. And it very obviously showed that he wasn't. But with LaFleur, I think there's a little bit more confidence because he's not that old-school type coach like Jimmy Johnson.
Agreed.
So another coach that I think about, and we'll go back to Indianapolis, was the guy who succeeded Tony Dungy. And it's a very fascinating case is Jim Caldwell, because he still is probably the most qualified head coach the Detroit Lions have had in the past 20 years. But focusing back on his tenure in Indianapolis, he took over what was already a Super Bowl caliber team and went 14-2 his first season.
And not to mention that team could have gone 16-0 if they didn't rest Peyton Manning the last two games.
You're right, and they lost them both to the Jets and Buffalo. And they ended up losing in the Super Bowl that year to the New Orleans Saints. This was the year before Green Bay went and won the Super Bowl. And with Caldwell in charge, Manning had complete control. This was Peyton Manning's offense. Caldwell was just kind of the head guy, controlled the locker room. He didn't really call plays. This was Peyton Manning. He had 33 touchdowns, 16 interceptions. But he took an offense with Joseph Addai as your leading running back, as your leading receiver being Dallas Clark and Reggie Wayne. Marvin Harrison was gone. You had Austin Colley and Pierre Garçon at that point, both young guys. And he took this young collection of talent and took them to 14 wins. But again, a lot of that ended up being Peyton Manning. Now you go on to year two in 2010. They went 10-6. They got bounced in the first round by the Jets in the wildcard round. And they took a step back. For Peyton Manning, he went 33-17, touchdown to interception. Donald Brown became their leading rusher. They didn't have a single guy over 500 yards. Dallas Clark took a step back. Reggie Wayne was their leading receiver with 111 catches. But very clearly, someone with Caldwell's personality, very soft-spoken, and he let Peyton Manning control that team in every way, shape, and form, they took a step back. And they may have been a better team than the year before. It's hard to tell, thinking about 9, 10, and 11 years ago. But with Caldwell, the Colts were never quite the same, and they got a little bit worse every year to the point where he was let go after 2011. He ended up going to Detroit for a few years because the next year in 2011 was the year Peyton Manning was out, and they went 2-14 with Curtis Painter. And Caldwell kind of got scapegoated by that, and he was sent on his way. So it's amazing to think where what could happen if Rodgers goes down. Caldwell could be the cautionary tale of that, but I do think LaFleur is not quite as reserved as Caldwell, and I think if he needs to, he can take charge, but the cautionary tale, I think, is Jim Caldwell for Matt LaFleur.
Yeah, you know, that's a perfect example of a team that just kind of went backwards every year. Still successful going 10-6 and making it to the playoffs, but definitely a step backwards. I don't see that happening with the Packers on the floor simply because when Caldwell came, it's not like Manning had to buy into a new system, you know, or he had to say, all right, you can't do this anymore. Now you need to do this. You can't do this physically. With Rodgers, it's, all right, this is a new system you need to buy into. If you buy into the system, it'll actually make you more successful in the long run. There will be some short growing pains. But if you keep going, you'll find success at the end of your career. Peyton Manning didn't really have to do that with Jim Caldwell. And so I feel like a lot of the stuff, you know, having a defense like Colts had that wasn't really good and then not having a great running game, I feel like it's the exact opposite with the Packers, where I feel their defense should be better next year. And running game-wise, keep Aaron Jones healthy, should have a – I'm not going to say he's going to lead the league in touchdowns, but I feel like – because I feel like a lot of teams are going to be game planning for Aaron Jones. But it's going to be I still feel like they're going to – like I said, they're not going to probably go 13-3, but they'll be a more complete football team.
Agreed. So let's just briefly touch on these last three coaches for us and – a couple of them are modern. We'll go with the older one first, and we're going to go back to 1989.
And George Seifert. Now, that guy is like, he's the GOAT when it comes to coaching in your first season and your second season, I feel.
For sure. He went 14-2 both years in San Francisco. He was there for 8 years. He won 10 games each time before going to the Panthers and completely tanking and getting fired after going 1-15. With that one win being over Minnesota, thank you, Chris Winkie. But in 1989, they goes 14-2 following Bill Walsh, and they slaughtered Denver in the Super Bowl 55-10. The one thing, though, his offensive coordinator that year was Mike Holmgren.
Mm-hmm.
But Montana goes 26 touchdowns, 8 interceptions. Steve Young plays in 3 games, he has 8 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. So you have 2 Hall of Fame quarterbacks there, one at age 33, one at age 28, and then you have some guy named Steve Bono. But you also got Roger Craig out there. You have Jerry Rice, John Taylor, former Packer coach Harry Sidney on that roster. So Seifert is the GOAT of the first-year head coaches. Like you said, 14-2, he wins the Super Bowl. Again, with Bill Walsh's team, Bill Walsh's system, and Bill Walsh's players.
And then not to mention, after he wins the Super Bowl, they start the next season 10-0.
Absolutely. They start 10-0. They end up going 14-2 again. But this time they lose in the conference championship to the New York Giants.
In one of the greatest games ever played. Montana, that was the game that really ended Montana's reign in San Francisco and began the Steve Young era.
And another thing also to keep an eye on as well is all of the future Packer coaches who were on that, besides Holmgren, you had John Gruden, Sherm Lewis, and Ray Rhodes on that coaching staff.
Yep.
But Montana started 15 games, Young started 1, Montana 26 touchdowns, 16 interceptions for Joe Montana, which was unheard of at the time. But again, not much of a running game. It was Roger Craig and Dexter Carter sharing it. Yeah, you had that elite receiver in Jerry Rice, but other guys were kind of behind the eight ball with Brent Jones and John Taylor. So again, very similar, older quarterback, really one go-to receiver, but here we got a better running game, and no one's accusing Matt LaFleur of winning with Mike McCarthy's players or Ted Thompson's players. This is Brian Gutekunst's team. This is Matt LaFleur's team. Whereas Seifert came in, and both years everyone says this is Bill Walsh's guys. These are Bill Walsh's players, his coaches, the team that he built. Seifert is kind of coasting along, and that ended up kind of sticking with Seifert for the rest of his career, and he never quite recovered from that kind of stretch to the point where he's not viewed as an elite coach nowadays. He's viewed as the guy who won with Bill Walsh's players.
Exactly, yeah. When Bill Walsh even admitted that when he retired after winning Super Bowl 23, he said, I just left the greatest team in the history of football. And, you know, because he was Mike Holmgren was the offensive coordinator, but he wasn't calling the plays. So in 89, Holmgren finally gets to call the plays with Bill Walsh's offense, and they didn't miss a beat. And so, of course, yeah, that was Bill Walsh's team. George Seifert was a defensive guy. And you take a look, his first 2 years being the head coach, the 49ers had the second-ranked defense in the league. So, yeah, so it's kind of hard to compare LaFleur with George Seifert. It's hard to compare any first or second year coach to George Seifert.
You're right, but I think he was good to bring up just because you think of the record that he had going.
Oh yeah,
14-2.
You had to bring it up just because that's like the gold standard. Even though he did kind of fall into a good situation, then again, you still have to give the guy his due.
Well, for sure. But so we'll go from 1989. We'll jump back into the more modern era, and by more modern, I mean this millennium. And let's talk about Sean Payton a little bit. Payton comes in 2006. They go 10-6 with the Saints right away, and they lose in the conference championship to the Rex Grossman-led Chicago Bears. But at that point, they had a 27-year-old Drew Brees at quarterback. He had 26 touchdowns, 11 picks, over 4,000 yards. You had Deuce McAllister running back. You had Marcus Colston as a young receiver. Joe Horn at the end of his career. But here's a guy, offensive guru, came from Dallas where he was with Bill Parcells. And now he's been there for 15 years, and he's still going strong. And I think this is kind of the blueprint you probably want LaFleur to follow, is the Sean Payton, because Payton got better and better and better at calling plays as the years went on. He became more and more and more of a complete coach, with the exception of the year he was suspended. But those first 2 years going 10-6, but he did drop to 7-9 in year two, which I don't think will happen for the Packers, but eventually Payton was getting incrementally better to the point where he ended up winning a Super Bowl in year four. And if we can get a Super Bowl by year four for Matt LaFleur, I think we have a long-term success as a head coach.
Yeah, you know, his rookie year, 2006, because the Packers hired McCarthy instead of Sean Payton, and Payton went to New Orleans. His first year coaching New Orleans was when Drew Brees came to New Orleans from San Diego. And so many people were wondering if Drew Brees was ever going to be the elite quarterback after his shoulder injury. And I feel like Sean Payton was like the perfect fit. Now, Drew Brees did go down and have a lesser season his second year under Sean Payton, but then rebounded immediately and had just the second 5,000-yard passing season in NFL history. Let's see. Yeah, it was his third year. You take a look, his interceptions went from 11 to 18. But then again, I don't know. Did you do a lot of research on the first couple of years with Sean Payton?
I did.
That was one I missed.
The first couple of years were very odd because, yeah, you had Drew Brees coming off the injury, but you didn't have any backups. And a lot of people thought that this was going to eventually be Reggie Bush's team because that was his first couple of years in the NFL too. But he never broke out, and Marcus Colston became the superstar receiver from them. But with Payton, he was known as the guy who helped Dallas kind of come back with Romo, and he helped navigate the Quincy Carter years. And Payton was a guy who was a little bit louder, a little more boisterous than guys like Mike McCarthy. But the question was always, can he get out of the shadow of that type A attitude head coach? Because he was under, like I said, he was under Parcells, and Parcells had that Dallas team on lockdown. Could Payton do the same with his own team? And I think we're seeing the same questions about Matt LaFleur. Can LaFleur take control of it, of a type A quarterback? Whereas Drew Brees was very moldable and came in, and I think he felt happy to be appreciated in New Orleans and getting signed there compared to what he was in San Diego when they drafted Phillip Rivers only a couple years after. Aaron Rodgers doesn't have to worry about that yet. I don't think Green Bay should have any quarterback high, at least the next couple years. But I think Payton growing as a play caller and growing as a coach is what LaFleur should be striving to do, and just become better and better each year, even though the record may drop a little bit.
Agreed. Completely agree.
And so last but not least, let's take a look at our last head coach, and that ends up being Mike Tomlin, which is a very fun story in and of itself. Tomlin, of course, takes over from Bill Cowher. Cowher retires after winning the Super Bowl. Tomlin comes in, he goes 10-6 in year one back in 2007. They drop out on the playoff round to David Garrard and the Jacksonville Jaguars. And it's a solid one. He has Ben Roethlisberger at age 25, a young quarterback, goes 32 touchdowns, 11 interceptions. Willie Parker was their star runner at the time, but they didn't have any elite receivers. Hines Ward was their leading guy with 730 yards. Santonio Holmes had 940 yards, but he averaged 18 yards a catch. Year two was the one where Pittsburgh really stepped up. They went from up to 12-4. They won the Super Bowl over Arizona in that one of the great Super Bowls I've ever seen. But Roethlisberger was more of a game manager. 17 touchdowns, 15 picks, but they rode a powerful defense and a very effective running game to the championship. And it's one of those ones where it's tough to see. It's tough to see. Also, Najee Davenport's on the team, by the way. Also, a fun little anecdote. But Tomlin, trusting his coordinators, trusting his defense, and relying on the trenches to win with Bruce Arians and Dick LeBeau as coordinators, veteran guys who have been and will later become head coaches in the league, I think is really helping out Tomlin. I think much like Mike Pettine has helped out LaFleur as that former head coach who kind of has been around and knows what's going on.
Yeah, and what I like about Tomlin is when he came to Pittsburgh, he was with the Vikings, and he was always used to a 4-3 defense. And he comes to Pittsburgh, and he sees the talent that they have, that they are built for a Dick LeBeau 3-4 defense. And instead of trying to completely scrap it away and say, this is where I come from, this is what I'm used to, we're changing to a 4-3, he said, no, let's keep the good thing rolling. Let's keep it in a 3-4. Dick LeBeau has this all under control. And it paid off. They win the Super Bowl. And so that's one thing I do give a lot of credit to Mike Tomlin. And I hope Matt LaFleur, people are wondering, you know, whether or not he should have kept Mike Pettine after this year. We'll see if it pays off.
Agree. And another thing also to keep an eye on was also the improvement of pass rushers from year one to year two under Mike Tomlin. James Harrison went from 8.5 to 16 sacks. Lamar Woodley jumped to 11.5 sacks when they won the Super Bowl. If we can see continued jumps like that from Za'Darius Smith, Preston Smith, Rashawn Gary, if they can find a middle linebacker who can play like James Ferrier, I think that'll help go a long way as well, because I think they have the secondary to, very similar as Pittsburgh had Polamalu and Clark and Ike Taylor in that secondary. I think that can emerge as well, but they also had a young Lawrence Timmons who played linebacker as well. So I think the defenses are built in very similar ways. They're built with those powerful, explosive pass rushers. And I think the way the team is built is a model for LaFleur. And again, Tomlin, a guy who, much like Matt LaFleur, as we've learned in interviews this past few weeks, a coach that the players have 100% respect for. And they know the coach has their back and they've got his back. And we've seen that now with Mike Tomlin over the past 10-plus years, especially this last year with the whole Antonio Brown thing. But Tomlin's a guy who, he's going to go to bat for his guys, he's going to stick up for his guys, and I think Matt LaFleur is going to be the same way.
Agreed.
So again, offseason, just kind of fun to talk about what to expect from year two with Matt LaFleur, and as we both said multiple times, 13-3 might be a stretch again for next year with tougher schedule. Probably won't have as good of luck on the training table as we did this past season, but looking back at a lot of these coaches who had Hall of Fame quarterbacks, who ended up some of them had Hall of Fame careers, guys like Tony Dungy, Sean Payton. It's interesting to see how they can compare to Matt LaFleur and what we can expect from year two from Coach LaFleur as he gets used to life as a head coach. And I think there's both good and bad to be taken from all of these previous coaches and what happened with them. So for that, we will say so long for now, everyone. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. And again, join us every single day for more Packers content as we continue through the offseason, get to the combine next week, free agency, the draft, and of course the beginning of training camp in the season later on this summer. So as we continue, Chris Shimma, where can people find you and what are you working on?
Not working on anything right now, taking it easy this offseason. But eventually I'm going to get back into it and start writing some more articles. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Shimma.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Mike Wendland. Jump right back into the Dairyland Express. I just dropped an article a few days ago about the Wisconsin Badgers combine and what you can expect from the four guys at the combine, what drills matter the most to them, and maybe, you never know, a couple of them could end up in Green Bay Packers. I would love to see Zach Bond and Quintez Cephas in green and gold next year. I would be very, very excited for that. But there's a lot going on around the world of sports, of course, in Green Bay. Packers football will never go out of season, even though it is technically the off season. So again, stay tuned every day for more Packers content on the Pack a Day podcast. Find it wherever podcasts are found, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, we are there. And stay tuned again every single day for more Packers content. And of course, and as always, Go Pack Go.
Hi, this is Nick Schmitz, one of the hosts of a Pack-A-Day podcast. Since you're a fan of the Green Bay Packers, you are probably a fan of Friday Night Fish Fries. It's a staple of Wisconsin heritage, and we want to let you know how you can support Friday Night Fish Fries. You can do this through supporting The Farmery. The Farmery is a nonprofit aquaponics farm and fish hatchery, and they are excited to launch their state-of-the-art yellow perch fish hatchery in downtown Green Bay. The hatchery will produce fish that aquaculture farmers can grow out and produce for your family's Friday Night Fish Fry. In partnership with the Green Bay Packers and the Greater Green Bay Community Foundation, The Farmery has been selected to receive matching funds as part of Give Big Green Bay, a 24-hour online giving event designed to rally the community around local nonprofits. From noon on Tuesday, February 18th through noon on Wednesday, February 19th, you can make your donation to The Farmery at www.givebiggreenbay.org. The Green Bay Packers and the Greater Green Bay Community Foundation will match every donation, which will provide high-quality learning experiences such as internships, job shadowing experiences, field trips, and community tours of the new facility. Donate online at www.givebiggreenbay.org and search The Farmery.